This is Alvin Walker.
Good morning. May it please the court, Oliver Davis for Mr. Walker. May I reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor?
You may.
I'm asking the court to find or to rule that the trial court erred when it declined Mr. Walker's request, made shortly after he entered his guilty plea, to withdraw that plea of guilty. The arguments that were raised in the opening brief and that we've defended in the reply brief are, first, that there was a conflict of interest. His counsel had a conflict of interest during the procurement of this plea that, under the conflict of interest rules, amounts to the IAC that amounts to the manifest injustice that requires that a plea be allowed to be withdrawn. The sequence of events here, very briefly, is that the defendant was found guilty at a trial. He filed a post-trial motion to attack those convictions. That motion was ultimately returned to the trial court by the Court of Appeals for a reference hearing and a hearing on the merits of the 7.8 motion. Shortly before that post-trial motion was to be heard, his trial counsel negotiated a plea of guilty for him, which he signed in court. However, he moved to withdraw that plea by letter to the trial court that very day. And looking at the plea documentation, there's a basis for him to withdraw that plea based on what happened during the negotiations, which is that his trial counsel negotiated a plea in which, by an appendix, he stated, "I am satisfied with the representation of counsel currently representing me."
Go ahead.
Can you explain how that's an exoneration of liability as opposed to something different?
Well, I think the ultimate legal effect of that statement is something that can be debated. To what degree is that would that hinder a person in their pursuit of an attack on the plea, whether that be by personal restraint petition, by this direct appeal? I'll actually note that the respondent in their briefing has pointed to another statement made by Mr. Walker during the plea colloquy or during the plea stage, in which he said, "Well, I'm satisfied with my lawyer's performance." And that statement is brought up by the respondent here to say, "Well, this was a perfectly good deal and Mr. Walker got an advantage from it."
Isn't the RPC addressing the situation where the lawyer tries to protect himself or herself from a subsequent direct claim against the lawyer by the client?
Yes, and I think in this case that the...
How does that fit with your argument about a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel later, which is not a claim directly against the lawyer, but is an attack on the conviction?
Well, it would certainly be the predicate to a civil claim for liability against the lawyer, a determination of ineffective assistance of counsel.
When you sue a criminal defense lawyer, except for a narrow area that doesn't apply here, you normally have to prove you're innocent. Not only that a jury would have acquitted you, but that you plain just didn't do it.
Sure. But the IAC...
thing that implicates that in this statement, is there?
Yes. The IAC would be... Mr. Walker maintains his innocence to this crime, and he believes that his counsel's ineffective assistance was an aspect of the plea arising because of the conflict of interest. And this court case law has been relatively clear, and it comes from the United States Supreme Court's decisions in Kyler v. Sullivan and Strickland, which essentially say that if you've established the two prongs for a conflict of interest, you've established the prejudicial IAC that allows a plea to be withdrawn. And those two prongs are that the the counsel was actively representing a different interest. In this case, we're referring to Rule of Professional Conduct 1.7, which is that the counsel's representation was limited by their own interests. And also that if liability, and this gets to your question, if the counsel is negotiating something that limits their liability to the client has to be represented by independent counsel. Now, whether the limitation...
carry too much water. Every time you negotiate for your client to admit the commission of a crime, you have eliminated civil liability. So is there a conflict every time I, as defense counsel, get my client to agree I'm going to plead guilty?
If in the process of providing that legal service, and here the service is post-trial motions or determinations whether they should be brought, abandoned, or a plea accepted. If you provided that performance as a lawyer, at the same time saying, and by the way, you've got to sign this thing that says you're satisfied with what I've done here. I made the...
You don't need that, though. I have a complete bar to civil liability by getting my client to say he did it.
Well, Your Honor, my argument is that if the attorney makes efforts to protect themselves from liability, whether it be civil liability or an accusation of ineffective assistance of counsel, which certainly could be a predicate to a civil claim against the lawyer for liability, you have a lawyer, to what effective degree one can debate at great length, but you have a lawyer who's actively representing different interests than the interests of the client. And in this case, the clause also implicates the requirement that independent counsel be provided to the client before liability is limited. So whether this is an effective limitation...
Other than this one statement, is there anything else that you're relying on to suggest that the attorneys were actively representing their own interest above that of their client?
Yes, and it has to do also with the question of the voluntariness of the plea, but a great deal of the litigation in the motion to withdraw plea was about, well, what did you say to Mr. Walker about this satisfaction clause? Well, the attorney, a fine attorney, the attorney said, well, I would have told him that language doesn't really mean anything and it doesn't matter. Well, that just doesn't make any sense, but it shows that you've got an attorney who's, to some degree, actively making representations to the counsel and to the client in order to obtain a particular clause that the attorney assumedly believes is in the attorney's benefit and not the client's.
Is there any evidence the prosecutor wanted this clause?
So there was originally, and it's quite confusing in the way it's described, there was originally a broader clause that says, I am not waiving my right to claim ineffective assistance of counsel. That was ultimately stricken, but this clause remains, and it clearly shows that the lawyer was actively representing a different interest, and performance was adversely affected.
It just seems to not say that. Because on the one hand, you're saying to him, look, you've got the right to claim ineffective assistance. That's what the lawyer wrote. And then you're saying you're satisfied. I mean, so that's a fairly inconsistent with your argument right now.
Of course, the statement that the defendant had the right to claim ineffective assistance was taken out of the appendix language, and what remained was something that, whatever its legal effect...
It was taken out because the prosecutor wanted it out.
The prosecutor wanted it out.
So, I mean, that doesn't show divided interests on the part of the defense counsel.
I believe it does. It shows the divided interest is shown by the fact that the client or the attorney received essentially a clause that might well make it much more difficult to claim ineffective assistance of counsel, at the same time taking the ineffective assistance of counsel waiver language out. So there's an active representation of a different interest that leads to a conflict
when you
of interest.
Back, could you answer this question? It happens all the time, but in colloquy with the court, defense counsel says, Your Honor, I reviewed the form with my client. We've gone over, I've answered all of his questions. He had no questions. I went over paragraph by paragraph. I'm satisfied. He's entered a knowing, voluntary, intelligent plea. I talked to him for 2 hours. La-di-la-di-la. Is there a conflict?
Good morning, may it please the court. Amy Meckling appearing on behalf of the state of Washington. what Mr. Walker has never shown, or apparently even made an attempt to show, that even if you assume for the sake of argument that the statement that he was satisfied with his counsel's representation was an actual conflict of interest, what he's never shown, which is he required to show, is that that conflict adversely affected the lawyer's performance. That's the second prong of what he's required to show in order to establish ineffective assistance of counsel in the context of this plea. And he's never made an effort to do that because he can't. That statement, while theoretically in some cases might make it more difficult for a defendant to claim ineffective assistance of counsel, couldn't in this case because his substantive claim is that he was misadvised. He was, his attorney, the substantive claim as to the involuntary plea was that his attorneys overstated the benefits of the deal and sort of understated the risks of what would happen if he didn't take it. That's his claim, is that they misadvised him of that and they didn't explain the rights that he was giving up. Well, whether they did...
The attorneys misrepresented the fairness with which he was likely to be treated by the judge?
No. I mean, I would take issue with that. He wrote a letter to the judge, an unsworn, handwritten letter to the judge, and said, I didn't think I would be treated fair. My attorneys told me that you wouldn't treat me fair. He didn't testify at the motion to withdraw his guilty plea. All he did was file a declaration. It was under oath, but he wasn't subject to cross-examination, and his declaration does not mention that. Nowhere in his declaration will you find any comments that his attorney told him the judge would not treat him fairly. So I don't believe that's the case. That's not before the court at the hearing.
So we don't take into consideration the letter that accompanied the motion?
No. Why would you? It was unsworn. He didn't include that information in his later sworn declaration. And I would also take issue with the fact that he didn't testify. It's when you go into court and you engage in a colloquy with the court that says, I understand these rights that I'm giving up. I understand the statement that I am signing. And the court asks you, do you understand it? Have you had enough time to discuss it with your attorneys? And you say, yes, I have. I understand it. And you sign it and you enter a plea of guilty. That is practically irrefutable. And it is the defendant's heavy burden to prove otherwise.
Does the defendant get sworn before he gets asked those questions?
He's not asked questions. Oh, I'm sorry, at the plea statement, the plea hearing.
When the defendant gets asked, do you understand you're giving up these rights? Is the defendant
No, he's not sworn.
And we take into account those statements?
Yes, you do.
Okay, why do we take into account those unsworn statements when we can't take into account the unsworn statements in the letter?
Because it's the state's burden to prove that his plea was voluntary. And once the case law is very clear for years that once the court finds the plea voluntary in court, it's practically irrefutable, and it's the defendant's burden to produce enough evidence to prove otherwise. He didn't produce that here. An unsworn letter to the court can't possibly suffice when you have his attorney's sworn, cross-examined testimony in front of the court. The trial court is entitled to take his counsel's...
You and I are talking cross purposes here. Whether it suffices or not is a completely different question from whether we can consider it as part of all of the evidence. My question to you was whether we could consider it. Your answer, I thought, was no, you can't even look at it.
Well, I didn't mean that. I'm saying that the trial court didn't appear to give it a whole lot of weight. And what your role as an appellate court judge is to determine whether there's substantial evidence to meet the trial court's factual findings.
Did the trial court consider it?
The trial court didn't mention it. What the trial court mentioned during her...
Was it argued?
It wasn't argued. No, that was never argued by the defendant's counsel. What was argued was that there was a conflict of interest because of the statement. That was primarily the focus. And then as well the overstating of the benefits of the plea and the timing that he had to consider it. So what the court said, and it's when the argument was going on, the court interrupted Mr. Walker's counsel and asked him, what do I do with this declaration, the sworn declaration that you presented? He didn't testify. How am I to consider that? And what his attorney said was, well, it is my burden to produce more than just that. But I have. He says that he should rely on his attorney's testimony, Ms. Torres' testimony. So he agreed that you got to have more than just that. I want to go back to this idea that he has to prove something more than an actual conflict of interest. That statement, I don't think, can by itself create a conflict of interest, because whether or not he was satisfied with his lawyer's representation is irrelevant to the point of whether or not they actually provided him with correct advice. Whether or not they explained to him what the statement meant, whether or not they overstated or understated anything, that's independent of whether he was happy with it. I mean, a criminal defendant is usually happy and satisfied with his lawyer's representation until the point in time in which he becomes dissatisfied with it. It's sort of a meaningless statement in this context. And whether or not the attorney drafted it with the purpose of insulating herself from a future claim of liability, I mean, if you're going to decide this case on that fact, that she must have had a reason to draft that statement, you should know that she didn't draft it. The prosecutor drafted it. The prosecutor wanted it in there for whatever reason. So as Your Honor pointed out, the entry of the guilty plea itself would waive any claim of civil liability. So that statement doesn't do anything. And Mr. Davis stands up and says that Mr. Walker still maintains his innocence. No, he didn't. He pleaded guilty with a straight plea. This was not an Alford plea. This was a straight plea. He admitted what he had done. And furthermore,
it was an Alford plea to the rape three and a guilty plea to assault.
That could be true. I apologize. When he said that, I looked at the statement briefly and I didn't differentiate between accounts. That's possible. However, what he was found guilty of by a jury was rape in the second degree. And that conviction by the jury was upheld on appeal. And there was no problem with that conviction. When Mr. Davis talks in his reply brief about, well, this court must have found his 7.8 motion to be meritorious because it remanded it to the trial court for a hearing on the merits, what happened is that Ms. Torres filed the 7.8 motion. The court transferred it pro forma with nothing. Ms. Torres called me, and I agreed to have it remanded for a factual hearing because factual hearing was necessary, not because it had any merit, in my opinion. We agreed to have it set back. We filed a motion.
Pro forma to the facts you're describing right now?
No, but to argue that there's...
How can we take that into account if it's not in the record?
Well, the record of what happened is certainly part this court can look at.
Well, I recognize the fact that there was a remand is a matter of record. But you're starting to tell us about telephone conversations and whatnot that aren't in the record.
No, the motion is in the record, and it's clear from the motion.
I understand the motion's in the record, and our order of sending it back to the trial court is in the record.
But our conversation's in the motion.
Okay.
And furthermore, I'll go further. With respect to the 7.8 motion, Ms. Torres asked the state, asked Mr. Walker if he would agree that she could open negotiations with the state once she decided that she had to strike part of her motion, the most viable part of her motion, because of whatever reason. And she approached the state about whether it was willing to make negotiations. Mr. Walker makes hay about, well, the state agreed to resolve this, so there must have been some merit to it. That's not necessarily the case. And to speculate about the reasons why the state would agree to not have to litigate something, and what we did is went back and forth and finally came to a resolution that was pretty much similar, just it got rid of a determinate sentence, an indeterminate sentence in favor of a determinate sentence. State didn't really give up a whole lot, and it didn't have to litigate the motion.
You really should move on.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. I'm just responding to some statements that were made. With respect to the timing of Mr. Walker's letter, I mean, Mr. Walker says, I wrote the letter to the court immediately that same day. The court got it a couple days later. Case law is clear that the timing of the defendant's request to withdraw his plea is irrelevant unless it's made after finding out some new information or discovering some consequence that he didn't already know. There's no information, new information that was, Mr. Walker simply changed his mind. He had regrets about it. Ms. Torres testified at the hearing. This was a difficult decision for him. He wasn't happy about the situation he was in. He didn't want to take the deal. He didn't want to particularly litigate his motion if it wasn't going to be successful. He didn't want to serve an indeterminate sentence that he was under. Essentially, he wasn't happy. He didn't like it. He entered the decision to plead guilty, and then he changed his mind. There's nothing more, and that's essentially what the trial court found. This court can't say that that was an abuse of discretion. And this statement that I'm satisfied with my lawyer's representation that the state wanted him to sign doesn't create an actual conflict of interest, and he hasn't shown how that statement adversely affected his lawyer's performance in this case. So I'd ask the court to uphold the trial court's decision.
Thank you.
So, Judge Lau, if even if the oral colloquy at the plea hearing stands as an unimpeachable demonstration that Mr. Walker understood what he was signing, that doesn't erase the fact that the document he signed, by its very printed language, attests to a conflict of interest within it that should allow him to withdraw the plea.
Doing so, you're insulating yourself from charges of ineffective assistance of counsel.
So that certainly an attorney should say that they've discussed the plea and it appears to be voluntary. The trial court makes that ultimate determination, of course.
If that were the case, then the scenario that I described to you, which is fairly common, would that be a conflict?
No, because the attorney would be representing to the court that he or she has fully represented the defendant's interest and right to plead guilty only intelligently and voluntarily. This particular clause in Appendix A to the plea agreement, and the respondent has stated that it's irrelevant, even if this satisfaction clause is completely irrelevant, or even if one can debate the extent of legal effect it might have, it's already had some legal effect. The respondent quotes a similar statement as part of the effort to convince this court is a great deal, the end.
Time's a little short, so let me interrupt. Should we be concerned about who originally asked for this language to be in the agreement?
No, because the typing was placed before Mr. Walker and his attorney asked him to sign it as part of the plea, even if it may.
Something the state's going to require as part of the deal.
Then it's going to.
How does that show a divided loyalty on the part of the lawyer for the defendant, which is what you're arguing it shows?
Because she got him to sign it, and as she admitted at the plea withdrawal hearing, it was designed to make him harder to argue ever that we committed IAC.
Doesn't it matter who designed?
No, I would say that it does not, because she asked him to sign it and the benefit accrues to her. There may be some other benefit to the prosecutor, but it's not the prosecutor that sat him down.
Decided I've had enough of these ineffective assistance claims. I'm going to require this in every plea agreement. Is every plea agreement after that with that language in it subject to attack on the basis you're attacking this one?
No.
Why not?
Because the prosecutor in this case never said we're not going to accept this plea unless this clause is in there.
Is that the only thing that saves it?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, counsel.